Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain at the hidden world of monetary control, control that determines global economic winners and losers and who benefits. Ellen Brown is a lawyer, scholar, and best-selling author of Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution. She's the founder of the Public Banking Institute and a prolific contributor to the growing discussion about the evolving world of economic theory. Later in the program, we'll take a look at new developments within the public banking movement. But now, here's Ellen. Money.
Thanks, Walt. Today, it's my pleasure to be talking to Mike Krause, who's one of the founding members of the Public Banking Institute and has done quite a bit of work organizing city-owned banks in Pennsylvania, which is an interesting concept. And he has a lot of experience and insights. So welcome, Mike.
Ellen, thanks. Great to be here.
So to start out with, how would you define a public bank? What's the difference between a public bank and a commercial private bank?
Well, I think the major difference is that a public bank is capitalized with public funds, and it serves a public purpose. Curiously, that's the Latin for republic, res publica, things of the public. So we're taking public money to form a bank that makes it a public bank, and that bank has public purposes. It supports many private efforts, but all those private efforts then fall into some kind of larger public purpose, which the bank supports, which private banks may not support.
So why would a state or a city particularly want a public bank? Don't you run the risk of corruption with politicians running a bank? And don't you run into the argument that bankers know banking and what does government doesn't do anything well, that sort of thing? How do you respond to those arguments, which I get all the time too? I also have answers to that, but...
Well, actually, we make those arguments. I would not want a bank run by politicians. It'd be a disaster. We want a bank run by bankers. And so governance is a key issue in how you set up a public bank. It's governance and it's management. And this is a bit of a contradiction. People always say, well, you don't want politicians running anything. Well, okay, so we give it to the experts. So we gave our banking system to the experts of the Federal Reserve. And that hasn't worked out so well. So you need to find the balance between the public and private interests here. We think that's manageable. In North Dakota, they've done a fine job of making sure the bank is run by bankers but accountable to elected officials. And that's really the trick. But that's, you know, I always like to say we're not inventing the wheel. We're just trying to roll it from North Carolina to Pennsylvania.
I get that question all the time. And then people object that North Dakota is only one state. It's got oil, et cetera. It's not like ours. They founded their bank in 1919. So that actually prompted me to write a book called The Public Bank Solution, where I looked globally and historically. And I was really surprised myself to find all the public banks in history and around the world. 40% of banks globally, it turns out, are publicly owned, which is shocking. I mean, nobody ever told us that in school. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a public bank till I got into this subject. And there are some recent studies that have show not only that public banks act countercyclically, and therefore those countries that have strong public banking sectors actually beat the credit crisis like North Dakota did, but they're also less corrupt than private banks. And you could see why that, or there, well, one study I saw that said the reason for this was likely to be the politicians actually liked private banks because they were more easily manipulated. A public bank is totally transparent, totally accountable, and they just can't use it for their purposes as much as they can manipulate private banks that are sort of in their pocket, or they're in the private bank's pocket.
I think it somewhat shocks people to come to that realization. If you wanted to know what J.P. Morgan Chase is up to, good luck to you. I mean, the Federal regulators don't know what they're up to. You know, when's the next lender whale going to happen? I saw an estimate from, I think, the Kansas City, might have been the Dallas Federal Reserve, that it would take another 7,000 regulators to give our banks the same kind of scrutiny that the Pennsylvania Department of Banking gives to our Pennsylvania banks. Well, they're not going to hire 7,000 regulators. In fact, they're going to lay more off. They don't want to be observed. A public bank, first of all, in Pennsylvania, is regulated by the Pennsylvania Department of Banking. That's one oversight. Secondly, because it's public, there must be a public audit of its funds. You'll get to see what they actually did with all their money, which you don't get to see with the big private banks. It's all, you know, behind the curtain. So public bank is actually a much more transparent and more accountable than any private bank is. The private bank wants one thing, big profits. The public bank isn't in that game necessarily. It makes a profit, but that's not its only reason for being. So, for example, in North Dakota, that bank is about $6 billion, and the CEO earns $250,000 a year. That's it. Not $5 million, not $15 million, not stock options for $30 million, none of that stuff. There are no bonuses or commissions for taking deals, so there's no incentive to do risky things. So a public bank is not only more accountable and not only more transparent, but you really take a lot of the risk out because you're just not doing those kinds of deals because you don't get paid to do them.
And even let's assume that it was all about profit for both public and private. The difference is, would you rather have the profits going to Wall Street bankers who then put it in offshore tax havens so it does not get returned to our economy? Or would you rather have it going into the government's coffers? I calculated in Web of Debt that properly done, you could actually fund the entire government without taxes if you allowed the government to actually make some money. And a principal moneymaker is banking. And in fact, we have the example of Pennsylvania in Benjamin Franklin's day. Do you want to tell that story? You tell that very well.
Well, it's a great little story. Pennsylvania in the early 1700s was enormously prosperous. Franklin reported, there was little unemployment. Everybody had a job, something to do. And he went over to England about 1750 and commented on all the poverty he saw. It kind of looks like America today. There was a small, very wealthy class, the aristocracy, who had everything, and I mean everything, and a very small, growing industrial kind of class, and then a lot of very poor people. And frankly, we just don't have that in Pennsylvania. And they said, why not? Well, he said, because we control our own money. And this came as news to the Bank of England and the bankers there who you know, they control the English pound. They put money into circulation. They earn the interest on that. Well, not in Pennsylvania. And they went the 1750 version of the nuclear and laid all over the king and parliament, and they shut down the right of the colonies, Pennsylvania, to print its own money. They took back control of the money and the credit. That's a huge moneymaker. I think it was Rothschild, one of them, who said, you know, give me control of a nation's money, and I care not who makes the laws. The money's in the money. And if your money comes by way of a private bank and you bring it into circulation at interest, they make that interest. If the public does what the Constitution says it should do, the Congress should control our money and credit, then that all falls to the government. That's us, the taxpayers, and takes a big bite of whatever taxes might be necessary to fund this government. So we're, in a way, we're just reaching back to what old Ben Franklin, old wise Ben did, and the rather prudent, sensible Quakers who founded this Commonwealth. They basically loaned money into the community at very low interest. They got that back, and that interest they got back took the place of taxes. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, during the time that they had there, it was called a land bank, a publicly owned land bank. They paid no taxes. They had no government debt, and prices did not inflate. They actually inflated a little because of foreign goings on, but they did not inflate as a result of an inflated money supply. The money supply did not inflate.
And the result of the bankers choking off the money supply in the U.S., and this is Franklin's own words, I'll quote them more or less right. He said, you know, we would have gladly borne the little tax on tea and other matters, but for this control of the money, which caused such a depression in the colonies that it was the cause of the revolution. That's what Franklin says. He thought the control of the English bankers of our money and credit and the choking off of that supply and the effect it had on the economy, that caused the revolution. And you can see why. You cannot grow an economy if you shrink the money supply. But the bankers wanted to control that money supply and make interest off that, lots of money off of that. So they basically choked it down where they supplied all the money. and it wasn't enough. And there was suddenly, he called it the first depression in the Americas. And that, Franklin said, and he was no dummy, Franklin said that was the cause of the revolution, something you don't find in our textbooks.
So in Pennsylvania today, what's the situation, and why do you feel Philadelphia could benefit from its own bank? Could you talk about what you're doing there and what the incentive is? I know Philadelphia has serious problems with, I think, interest rate swaps and with their schools being shut down for lack of money and so forth.
That's true. The city and the school district together, in I think 2012 and just before, lost collectively $500 million on interest rate swaps with Wall Street. The school district lost about $250 million. Interestingly, that's almost the exact shortfall in their budget, because of which they're laying off teachers, closing schools, you've got classrooms without textbooks, you've got schools without nurses, you've cut all sorts of extracurricular programs from sports to debate club, you name it, they've been slashed to the bone. This is a disaster for public education, among other things. And this recession has caused massive unemployment in a city like Philadelphia, many in the United States. You know, whatever the national average is for unemployment, 7.8, 8, I don't know what it is. It's two or three times that in many places in the United States. Our young people, our minorities, middle-aged men who will never get back to work. This is a slow-moving social catastrophe. So folks are waking up to that fact. And I think what folks are waking up to is that looking to Washington to solve this problem, you're going to wait a very long time. They don't seem to be interested. But some good people are. But collectively, the Congress nor the administration have the will, it appears, to do much about this. In fact, they're going to, not continue unemployment benefits. They're going to reduce food stamps. Besides the fact that it's just plain cruel, you cannot grow an economy by shrinking the money supply. You can only grow an economy if the money supply expands. Well, since we can't look to the Washington and probably not to our state capital, where can you look? You can look to yourselves. And how can you do this? And this is an important point here. Most states and cities have been crying poor for 5 years. You look at your operating budget, and oh my goodness, it's just terrible. But if you look at what's called the Consolidated Annual Financial Report, a CAFR, C-A-F-R, that shows you what all the city's agencies, commissions, boards, authorities have sitting around. In Philadelphia, there are on the books almost $2.5 billion of investments. Invested all over the place. And it's kind of curious to read the financial statements because they're footnotes. And one footnote in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia discusses how they mitigate foreign currency risk. And you go, foreign currency risk? What does that mean? It means that the people of Philadelphia, their money from their taxes, from their fees, from whatever it is they pay, not only is not invested in their city, it's not even invested in Pennsylvania. It's not invested in the United States. This money goes in these different funds, which are managed by managers or get fees, and they send it all over the world chasing down returns. It's not coming back to Philadelphia. It's not coming back to Pennsylvania. That's something we want to change. And that, by the way, is $12.5 billion. Maybe I said million. $12.5 billion, which Philadelphia owns.
Do you want to explain for our listeners what interest rate swaps are and what the banks have to do with them?
Interest rate swaps are a bet. Sometime in, after the Graham, Leach, whatever bill allowed bankers to become, gamblers, basically, they began to sell different products, financial products. And they came to cities and said, interest rates might go up. So we're going to buy this swap. And if interest rates go up, we pay you. If they go down, you pay us. It's a 50-50 deal. They'll probably go up and down a bit, up and down, up and down. It'll all even out. And they sold these swaps all across America, to school districts, to cities, to local governments, to universities, all over the place. And then guess what? In the crash, interest rates went down. And this caused the cities and others who have these swaps to have to pay out all kinds of money, big-time money. If rates had gone up, the banks would have had to pay out. Now, think about this. Some guy or gal in a $3,000 suit or pantsuit with a 28-page PowerPoint comes to your city And, you know, you've got a school board and you've got a fireman and a butcher and a baker, not really a financial expert. They hear this stuff and they go, oh, that sounds good. And they buy these deals. And suddenly in the collapse, interest rates get pushed down. Now, why would that happen? Well, it happens because, in my opinion, the biggest banks have over $700 trillion of exposure in derivatives, many of which are interest rate swaps. If interest rates had gone up, they'd be paying out. They went down, so the cities are paying out. And the reason, in my opinion, that the Fed's not going to ever really raise interest rates a whole lot is, at that point, the banks make less money. And if they go above a certain point, they're actually paying out. And instead of Philadelphia paying the banks $500 million, they'd be paying Philadelphia $500 million. We can't have that. So the interest rate swaps were a hustle, in my opinion. And unsophisticated money managers at the local level got taken for a ride.
Right. And then there's the question of who determines what the interest rates are. Why? It happens to be the Federal Reserve, which is the head of the private banking system, composed of 12 branches, all of which are 100% owned by the banks in their district. So it is, in effect, a banking cartel, a private banking cartel. And the Federal Reserve itself drove the interest rates down to extremely low levels. 0.25% is the interest rate on that banks lend to each other. So it's like going to Las Vegas and you bet against the house, and the house rigs the bet.
You know, I was in Las Vegas really for a conference, and even machines took me. I had a machine. I wanted a Coke out of it. It was a $2 machine. It took $3 of my dollars before I got a Coke. So even the machines are rigged. So so are our banks. Let me make a point about that. The Fed, all the banks, almost every bank in America, belongs to its local Federal Reserve. And they like to say that the Fed's owned by all the banks of America. But there are banks and there are banks. Just as any corporation, there are majority shareholders and minority shareholders. So yes, your local bank and trust has some shares in the Federal Reserve, but that's nothing compared to the shares held by J.P. Morgan, by Citi, by those guys. They hold the big shares. They drive the Fed, and the Fed works for them. So yes, all the banks in America belong to the Fed, but all banks are not created equal, and the banks that have, you know, trillions of dollars of assets have a lot more say than your local bank with 5 or 6 billion big time. More likely tens of millions, they don't really have a vote. It's all done out of the Fed in New York and Washington.
Actually, I think they each have one vote. I'd have to check into that. But they definitely, the big banks have more clout. For example, the New York Fed has Jamie Dimon on its board. The board of the New York Federal Reserve has the head of J.P. Morgan Chase. And when Bear Stearns went bankrupt, or allegedly went bankrupt, that's not even clear. They were kind of forced into bankruptcy. J.P. Morgan got a huge loan from the government to buy out J.P. Morgan's shares at pennies on the dollars. So they got a very good deal on this, supposedly saving Bear Stearns. But what they did was they gobbled up Bear Stearns very cheaply with the government loan. So clear conflict of interest, and you would wonder, why is that allowed? It's allowed because there's nobody powerful enough to stop them.
What I'm struck by is how rigged our economy has become. The interest rates are rigged. The bond market was rigged. The mortgage market was rigged for fraud from top to bottom. And now we're finding that even the basic economy, like commodities, the banks now are buying up, big banks are buying up everything. They're not just buying up commodities like aluminum. They're buying up all the means of distribution and the warehousing. And they're controlling businesses, nothing to do with banking, are now being gobbled up by the big banks. And suddenly, you know, not everything, that's a bit of hyperbole, but a great many of the products that we depend upon, that we have, are also now being controlled by the same banks. And I, you know, just feel like the economy is just this giant machine to extract money from the American middle class until they get every last nickel in your pocket. And they're succeeding. The middle class is shrinking. And those who are already poor, you don't want to know. It's really terrible all across America. And people are stressed no end. and looking for some relief. And I think that public banking is that relief. It's, if you wanted to change the economy and you tried to do it in Washington, I think it would not succeed. Think of it in military terms. They are simply too well dug in. It's like Normandy during D-Day, pillbox, machine guns. They're really dug in. Our best bet, in my opinion, is a flanking motion. Just go around them. Go to our states and cities and make them fight this battle in 1,000 places.
Yeah, I would agree. It does seem like we're slaves, literally slaves, to a master that we don't recognize. We all know we're in debt. People know that they can't get jobs or that they're only getting paid $10 an hour and they can't possibly do the things that are, well, like put their kids through college or pay for medical bills on $10 an hour, but they don't have a choice. And why is that? It's because of our money and credit system, and all that could be changed. We're at that period in science and technology where we could save the planet from the devastation that we see going on, and we could feed the people. We could feed all the people if we put our resources into developing all these scientific ideas that you hear in, like, they're budding ideas or ideas that they can't get funding to develop. I've heard lots of these great ideas. You don't necessarily need oil. You can get energy out of there's zero point energy. There are all sorts of free energy possibilities if we put resources into developing them. But we don't have the resources because we don't have the money. And that's obviously intentional. The oil business wants to dominate the energy field, and the bankers want to dominate the money field. So how do we get around it? Like you say, we need to do a flanking. We need to just set up our own. We can't really fight them. They're too big, but we can set up an alternative model.
I agree with that. And I go back to some years ago, I must confess, I was a college student and a government major. And I got government 101, and it boils down to this. In any society, power, political power, is a function of wealth, and wealth exercises power. And when wealth is concentrated, then so too political power is concentrated. We've allowed this grotesque concentration of wealth in America. We all know the stats, the gap between the rich and poor, the incomes, how much. We all know that stuff. But it's a practical matter. That means that they basically drive the government. The biggest banks now account for 60% of all domestic American profits. So, of course, the government responds to them in ways both normal and ways kind of unseemly when you get right down to it. But that's the reality. So what do you do about that? Well, if you can break that concentration of wealth and get wealth more broadly shared, as it was in this country from after the Second World War into the 70s, when we had, I think, the greatest and most broadly shared prosperity the world had known, if we can go start working our way back towards broadly shared prosperity, then the power will also flow that way. It will begin to decentralize again. I think our, I was going to say salvation, that's maybe too messianic a term, but our help, I believe, is in each other, in the tremendous diversity of this country. And if we can enable that diversity, there's, as you were pointing out, more than enough smarts and talent and good ideas to do great things for the ones I worry about, the next two generations of my family. I'm really concerned that they're simply not going to enjoy the kinds of freedoms and opportunities that I enjoyed, and I think that's criminal. So I think that deconcentrating that wealth is the step, you know, to creating broadly shared prosperity, restoring our democracy, and giving the young people of this country a chance at the kind of opportunities that you and I had, I think, Ellen. That's really where I'm coming from.
Yeah, well said. I've studied this question now for, 12 years recently, but long ago as well, about the whole financial system and how it should be fixed. And it seems to me what's wrong with the system is that we have the wrong conception of money. We think of money as something that you have to get, like you have to dig it out of the ground or you have to borrow it from somebody. Even going back to the Bank of England requiring the colonists to borrow the Bank of England notes or to borrow gold, which the Bank of England notes supposedly represented. But in fact, money is merely a monetization of IOUs or promises to pay. I mean, it's really a big mutual credit clearing system. And now that we have the internet, it would be quite possible to run all that without the old-fashioned sort of banks. I mean, it could all be done on the internet without middlemen, and it could theoretically run smoothly. Anyway, I think we're at the verge of a new era, a new golden age, if you will. But in order to get there, we have to figure out how to make the banking system run without this parasitic drain on all our profits and proceeds and resources.
Well, I like that. That's something that banks understand. It's good old business. Let's take out the middlemen. That's yeah. Basic business 101. They'll understand.
Yeah, they've got the, and the thing is, people don't even recognize it. They've got the boot on our necks, and we don't recognize it. And so for me anyway, that's what I'm trying to do, is just shed light all the time on this subject. Going back to Pennsylvania though, do you want to explain more about what public banking could do specifically for Philadelphia?
Well, actually rather a lot, but basically what are the big things we know about public banking? First of all, it gets affordable credit into the community for a wide variety of enterprises, businesses, commercial activities. We know that part. And that, of course, would drive employment and would increase tax revenue. We know that. We also know that public bank can share its profits with the government that created it. As, for example, the Bank of North Dakota has been reliably returning $30 million a year of bank profits back into the general fund of North Dakota. So it can do that. But a public bank can also be more specifically targeted to the needs of the community. In many places, in Pennsylvania anyway, and elsewhere, you hear a lot of talk about using public banks to facilitate the new economy, sustainable and green businesses. And that may be what a Bank of Philadelphia might do. Our position, our job, I should say, as the Public Banking Institute and the Pennsylvania Project, is to facilitate that discussion. It'd be a bit much for us to say, hey, Philadelphia, here's what you should do with your bank. The folks in Philadelphia will decide that one. And we are having meetings all over the city with citizens groups to do just that, to bring forward that discussion of what they think the bank should be focused on. And in Philadelphia, I wouldn't be surprised if they focused on education and also vacant buildings. The city of Philadelphia has 40,000 vacant buildings. The city owns 10,000 of those. They are blights all across the city. There are parts of Philadelphia that look like London after the Blitz, and that's true of many cities. You take a ride in Amtrak from New York down to Washington, and going through Philly and Baltimore and Washington, you look in the backsides of row homes just falling away. It looks like they were bombed. These are terrible drains on the welfare of a city, on the psychic welfare of the city, just on their good feeling about themselves. So I wouldn't be surprised to see a public bank in Philadelphia take some role in helping to fund the reclamation of those abandoned properties, whether they're, you know, rehabbed into housing or taken over for local commercial businesses, turned into gardens. I can't say, but the need's there. And I get this feeling. Philadelphia, by the way, now has a land bank, which is interesting. They're going to start acquiring these buildings. Well, then what? And where's the money come from? I think there's a partnership out there between the local banks, the land bank, the public bank, the builders, and the trades unions to start doing something with these blighted properties. I don't know exactly where the fit is, but my instincts tell me there's a fit there. That may be what Philadelphia does with a public bank. It a lot will depend on what the community thinks its needs are and how they design the bank, and it will probably differ from place to place.
So, Mike, we can probably expect some pushback from the big banks. What do you think, and how would you respond to that?
Well, they're going to push back any way they can because this threatens market share. And even more directly, if a city or a state has its own bank, then it need not put its deposits in the Wall Street banks. It could put its money in its own bank. And around the nation, that's some trillions of dollars. And if that money starts to leave the Wall Street banks and they have fewer reserves, they can't gamble to the extent they want to gamble. They can't support the gambles. Well, not responsibly. They'll probably go on gambling anyway, but not responsibly. So they really don't like this. They want every nickel. So they will push back. And I expect they'll do it the old-fashioned way. They have lobbyists, teams of them. And when we bring forward a bill for a Philadelphia Public Bank and have hearings before council, you can expect the suits to start descending from Manhattan I like to do high level bombing, but they'll probably just take the Acela down from New York. They won't fly in, I don't think. And they'll show up in the state legislature. They already have, as a matter of fact. We have another county that expressed strong interest in a public bank. And their legislator asked the question of the banking secretary the other day what he thought about it. And that sent the lobbyists just off on a tear. And they're writing their members of their associations and write everybody and tell them this is a bad idea, it's illegal, it's not American, it's socialist, all those things. So that's going to happen. And that's one reason why a state bank is really a daunting task. That takes a lot of time and effort. It was once said, John D. Rockefeller is supposed to have said, or was said of him, that he could do everything with the Pennsylvania legislature except refine it. And there is still a lot of opinion in Pennsylvania that our legislators are very aware of what lobbyists are thinking and somewhat less aware of what their own voters are thinking. There's some sentiment to that effect. I'm not sure I share it. They're all, laudable people. But nevertheless, the lobbyists spend a ton of money and they get heard. And it's harder for citizens to get heard. And that, again, is why we're moving this fight locally. We want this out in front of city council members. But when you go to a meeting in Philadelphia and you want to speak, the first question is not only what district are you from, what neighborhood are you from? And last time I checked, Manhattan wasn't a part of Philadelphia. And when those guys have to testify publicly, it's going to be obvious who they are and what they want. So we have to push this fight into the public arena, as might be. It's a public bank. We don't need a private discussion behind closed doors. It used to be the smoke-filled room. Now it's Brie and Chablis. Same thing. I know the lobbyists are cornering the legislators, and they're making the decisions, often writing the legislation. We're going to write this legislation and put it on council's desk and have a fair shot at this. And we'll get the lobbyists out in the public light, and we'll see which way elected officials want to go. I think we can make a very strong case that it makes sense to take some portion of the city's investments, which are not performing all that well, and instead of a hedge fund in Copenhagen, take an equity position in a public bank. I think we can demonstrate better returns. I think we can demonstrate a better life for the people of the city of Philadelphia if they put their local money to work locally. So we're going to make a very simple argument. There will be pushback, but if it's done out front, in the public, I think we have a really good opportunity to push this to a successful conclusion in lots of places.
There's also the safety factor, the bail-in situation. You made a video on that. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
Well, that's another argument. That's something, Ellen, that I should nod to you. You put it out there that, when Cyprus went down and the depositor woke up one day and found their deposit had been raided, that wasn't like, oh, they just thought of that. That was the plan, in effect, from the European Central Bank, the Bank for National Settlements, the Bank of England, and the U.S. FDIC. Globally, there is a plan in place put there by bankers who report to nobody but other bankers, no parliament, no Congress, to bail in. That is, because Dodd-Frank says you can't bail out the banks anymore, I guess they're afraid people might get really upset, did it again, they're going to bail in. They're going to attach unsecured deposits, unsecured creditors. Well, you, at your local bank, you've got $25,000 on deposit or more, let's say $100,000. You're unsecured. When you put your money in the bank, it's theirs. They own that money. You have an IOU. If they go under, you don't have it. Meantime, if they're floundering, if they can't get a bailout from the government, they can attach your deposits. And suddenly you've got, instead of $100,000, you've got $50,000 that's available, and 50,000 in shares of a bank that's in trouble. Now imagine you're a city like Philadelphia, and you've got $400 million on deposit on any given day, and the bank starts to go down, and they start attaching those deposits, half of them, let's say. So suddenly you don't have $400 million, you've got $200 million and a bunch of shares of stock. Try meeting your payroll with shares of stock in a failing bank. That's a potential disaster. And I think that's in the cards. And this is not fanciful. I'm not making this up. The documents are there. Position papers by the Bank of England, the FDIC, all sponsored by the Bank of Banks, the Bank for International Settlements. And you've got all these, just as in Europe, these bankers decided to push Greece into receivership. No government decided that. Bankers did. and they control the levers. So we need to be watching out for just, in fact, how safe is our money on deposit with one of the big banks? That should be a real concern for policymakers. You know, not only is it morally repugnant to do business with crooks, I mean, why would you bank with J.P. Morgan given their record of fraud? I mean, that's crazy. You know, you don't typically want a banker who's been accused of 45, 50 different frauds. That doesn't, I don't know, somehow that's not banking to me. Certainly not a banker, not what I want to do business with. But not only is it morally repugnant to do business with these guys, it might not be safe at all. Those big banks might be quite vulnerable to another collapse, and they may come take your deposits as they start to go down because they will save themselves first. You know, men, women, and children first, not with the bankers.
Yeah, another, I know that politicians tend to say our deposits are collateralized, so we're not worried, because when public funds are put in a bank, the bank has to come up with an equal amount of security, or I think in California it's 110% of what the public revenues are put on deposit. But as it turns out, the securities that the Wall Street banks put up to cover these deposits are not segregated. We've seen that in the MF global crisis, where these gold deposits were supposedly deposits of particular investors, and in fact, they were confiscated by J.P. Morgan, and J.P. Morgan wound up with the goods because they were used for collateral in this collateral chain. And the law is, whoever owns the collateral, it's sort of like musical chairs. If you've got the collateral, when the thing goes down, you own it. So the depositors weren't able to get it, and the public funds are in the same situation where they're using this collateral, usually federal securities, they're using it as collateral in the repo market to gamble.
That's true enough. I mean, and I like the analogy of musical chairs. Last time the game started, there were like, you know, I don't know, 9 big banks, now there are 7. Next time there'll probably be 4. And I think that's what they want. I think they're driving for a further concentration. Because those left standing have even more wealth and even more power. This is a game of musical chairs played by sharks, you know, it's pretty ugly. And they'll tear each other apart. They did it to Lehman. They did it to Merrill Lynch. They did the Bear Stearns. They'll do it to Philadelphia and not think twice about it.
Okay, well, it's great talking to you, and good luck with your efforts there in Pennsylvania.
Thanks, Ellen. They're very much our efforts. We are all in this together, we recognize anyway. And I think gradually lots of folks are also beginning to figure out that we, the public, are really under the gun here, and we, the public, better do something about it.
Right. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Ellen.
That was Pennsylvania Project Chair Mike Krause. It's time now for this week's Public Banking Report. A quick look at what's going on around different parts of the country where citizens are pursuing creation of public banks. Starting out west, the city of Santa Fe, New Mexico, recently held a 2-day gathering of city officials and business and civic leaders who are intently studying the creation of a city public bank. A well-organized group of citizens brought forward the necessary data that enabled the group to evaluate what impacts such a plan would have, and that set the stage for the next level of project development, the creation of a business plan for a city public bank to be reviewed and approved by civic authorities. Assessing the existing municipal assets through a review of the city's comprehensive annual financial reports, as we discussed with Scott Baker on this report recently, is one of the first steps that is needed to help determine whether a local public bank can be capitalized without going into further debt. Up in the Northwest, in Seattle, the public banking focus there has shifted from a statewide bill that was proposed in the state Senate and previously in the state House over the past 2 years to a focus on the city of Seattle itself, bringing into view the opportunities for a public bank to impact the lives and investments within city limits. It's an action that's harmonious with the city's recent acceptance of a $15 minimum wage. With the support of a new mayor and a popular new socialist councilperson, the group that's supporting Seattle's adoption of a public bank is growing in size and diversity of talents, and they're planning on holding a fall conference to unify public support and to educate the public about the issue. South of Seattle, in the city of Tacoma, Washington, a city councilman there has begun an in-depth review of what city funds might be used to capitalize a public bank, to take a look at what they're currently paying for management and interest expense on city loans and bonded indebtedness, and they're checking out the legal aspects of city adoption of that course of action. Similarly, initiatives are underway in San Francisco, Mendocino, California, and a nascent effort in Los Angeles, where that city is spending more money on payments to Wall Street through a variety of its financial obligations than it is on repairing city streets. In Colorado, a statewide effort there continues for the past couple of years and undergoing a dogged review of the various aspects of what it would take to make a statewide public bank work. Out on the East Coast, the state of Vermont has had a rousing period of discussion, debate, and electoral outcomes that showed very strong support for a state-based public bank. The driving theme centered on the costs that are associated with the state paying large fees for interest, management, and investment services, and the fact that those investments were generally not even made within the state, thereby reducing the benefits that state monies could have on local Vermont economies. As a result of a recent statewide election, an initial step in the general direction of creating a public bank for the state was agreed to by the state legislature that moves a percentage of their state funds out of their big bank partner and into the state's Economic Development Authority to create more local investment. And in Pennsylvania, a statewide team of public banking protagonists from a wide assortment of backgrounds, which include bankers, professors and other academics, politicians, and citizen network activists, have made significant strides. A team of Pennsylvania Project leaders recently met with the heads of the state's banking department to discuss their intention to submit applications for new public bank charters and the steps and conditions that will be required to pull that off. There are currently four Pennsylvania municipal entities, including its two largest cities, that have some form of movement underway heading toward the creation of new public banks. One of those locations is in Pennsylvania's northeast city of Wilkes-Barre and its surrounding Luzerne County, which is where our public banking report guest comes from today. Ed Braminski is a seasoned public official, the vice chair of the Luzerne County Council, and he has a bold vision for helping his broader community to get out of its classic losing financial horizon. It has over $340 million in debt, which will take another 12 years to retire, and it also has recurring annual budget deficits. As you'll gather in our sort of over-the-backyard-fence conversation with Ed, such a new idea inevitably brings up entrenched resistance and skepticism. But that seems to be something Ed takes in stride.
Well, hi, Ed.
Hi, Walt. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. How are you doing up there?
Good, good, good.
I'm really delighted that you're able to join us because I think that one of the things of great interest to people around the country who are pursuing the public banking strategy, ultimately they run up against people in your position as officials, elected officials, to implement and to apply the concept. So I thought it'd be really useful to talk with you about how you got into it, how you see it applying and its value, and some of the other aspects of it that we'll gauge along the way. So let me ask you, how did you come across it?
I have a friend of mine who is a newspaper writer. And last year, probably in around June, July somewhere, he sent me an article from a newspaper that he had picked up online about the prospects of government-owned bank or county bank. So I had no idea about it, so I contacted a fellow from here in Wilkes-Barre in Kingston who I taught in school and is a financial analyst, and I forwarded the information to him, and he found it intriguing, so he got a hold of Mike Krause, and they began to communicate back and forth, and then I was providing them with the numbers that they were asking me on our budget and whatnot, and from that point on, they got it rolling, and that's how I became involved. And the reason I became involved is because I was looking for a way for us to get out of the hole. We're in dire straits here in our county. We're probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $360 million in the hole. And we have to come up with new ways and innovative ideas for raising revenues in our county.
it's quite a deficit to have to deal with. What kind of solutions or alternatives do you have for problem solving?
Well, I've been trying to come up with a variety of ideas. We have about 1,400 acres of forest land in our community, and I proposed the idea of foresting the land, not clear-cutting it, but selective cutting it. And there's an organization that I've been following who do that kind of business, and it would be an annual thing, but I can't get support from the council because they just don't understand that this is not clear-cutting, and the manager kind of likes to do things on his own, and he doesn't like you to come up with ideas. He wants to think of them himself. And the bank was the second issue that I came up with, and we've got some rather large parcels of land that we're now attempting to sell in order to get some money to reduce the deficit. But when it comes to continuous revenue ideas, it's difficult right here. I mean, we have a good location. We have the land. We've been trying to advertise the land as New York does with these Keystone Opportunity Zones where a new business can come in and take over the land for 10 years tax-free, and then after that, you know, start paying taxes. So we tried a number of things.
So the entrepreneurial prospects for government management and problem solving, reaching out there, isn't it? I mean, it's, I suppose if you wanted to retire that deficit, you'd have to also go into debt or raising taxes or, and now you're talking about selling assets.
Yeah, we got a $27 million annual payout on the bonds that they took. So out of a $123 million budget, the first 27 of it goes to pay off the bonds, and after that we have to use that money to meet our expenses. And to date, the only solution that our managers come up with is to fire people and raise taxes.
Right.
I'm saying this in all humility. I presented the ideas to the whole council about the bank, and I've had no response to it. I presented an idea about establishing a land bank for the county last year, and there was no response to it. And all of a sudden, one of the councilmen who I believe wants to run for office came up with the idea of a land bank a year after I proposed the idea. And
I see. So you got some political.
Everybody seems to want to get into a position where there is some notoriety. I said. Someone said to me, what's my objective? I said, I don't have any objective or I don't have any ulterior motives. I said, I'm 75 years old. I got one foot on a banana peel and the other one in the grave. So what do I don't have anything to do except to see if I, you know, I've lived here my whole life. I was a county commissioner for 4 years, and we ran a good operation when I left after 4 years at that time with about, I would say, $900,000 to $1 million budget. I left office with a $500,000 surplus, and you know, the two major ideas that I wanted to get promoted was the forcing of our lands and the bank idea. That was something that really, really intrigued me.
How would you see using a public bank? Would it be a Luzerne County bank?
Yes. My idea of it, after having attended the seminar in Harrisburg and all of the literature that I get, would be to establish it as a source of community loans, and they could all take advantage of it by borrowing at extremely good rates. They could start some new ideas in their own communities to start to increase their revenues, because we have some of the towns that are struggling right now, particularly because of the police enforcement situation. It's getting costly.
Well, what about your bonded indebtedness? Any interest in trying to renegotiate or reestablish those bonds through your own bank
ability? That's something that I've made a suggestion to. However, I can't get involved in it because it's supposed to be, since we have a charter form of government, that's a management responsibility. And, if there is bond negotiation going on right now, truthfully, I'm not aware of it. Don't do anything, we'll have our bonds paid off in 2027. So that's 13 years.
13 years
paying on them.
Do you happen to know what kind of an interest rate you're paying on your bonds?
Of the bonds are 7%. Some of them are 8%.
Wow.
And with that in mind, a community bank would serve us well.
Well, in that kind of a rate, you're about doubling your indebtedness every 7 or 8 years, right?
The actuaries, I guess, have it figured out, or the auditors, I don't know what it would be, have it figured out that, you know, they gave us a projection, and they estimate, or they told us, that we should have it paid off by 2027.
Well, I know you've got at least one banker and other financial people involved. Are any local bankers, any community bankers in your area interested in this and supportive of it or against it?
I have talked to a number of people who are involved in banking. One particular one, is skeptical, but yet interested. Another fellow who was involved in banking, as a matter of fact, I sat down with him last Thursday. And he and I sat for lunch and we discussed it. And, I expect him to get more involved in it. But there is the idea that they like it, but, you know, certainly some of them are afraid there's going to be competition. And I forward all the information I get from them to hopefully assure them that this is not a competitive situation for them. Yeah.
Any contact or a pushback from larger banks?
Not yet. To me, no. No one's expressed any issues with me so far, even though, I speak about this frequently. I have had some people, we don't need another bank run by politicians. I said, it's not a bank run by politicians. See, people just don't understand the concept of it.
You're referring to the separation between the political parties and the professional management of a public bank, the county.
Right. They think that it's going to be, there's going to be all kinds of political shenanigans going on. And it's because of their lack of knowledge. I have some difficulty getting the right word out. You know how it is with newspapers and radio. They'll do their editing. That makes a good story. I remember a fellow told me one time, just don't let the facts interfere with a good story. And that's the way it's done.
And your public response, generally, I mean, you've had a little bit of negative pushback along the lines you just sort of described, but what kind of positive feedback do you get, or is it just all one-sided?
No, well, I have to say it's more negative than positive. And it gives me an opportunity when someone's negative to try and explain to them exactly what it is. And, we have 365,000 people in the county, so for me to do it one person at a time, it'll take a while. But I keep trying. Everybody I get a chance to speak to on it, I do. I know Mike Krause was on the radio about it, and they talked about it. And, of course, they're all the naysayers that call in. And those people that are in favor of it don't. Fortunately, I haven't had a great number of people who have expressed a negative attitude with me. A lot of people like the idea of doing progressive things. But, of course, they're the more professional people, which our county is not. Maybe 25-30% of the county are really professionals. We're a large percentage of senior citizens.
And how do you see it proceeding? I mean, you're obviously up against the initial response to any new idea, which is typically, we can't do that, or it shouldn't be done, or whatever.
Right.
And, you have to expect some of that. How do you intend to work through or pass that?
I tried to get to various organizations to speak to them. There's a group up here called the Northeast Leadership Group in our area. There's about 20 people to it, but in total, in the Northeast section of Pennsylvania, there are probably 200 members. And I've approached them and talked to them, and there's some good business people in there. And they like the idea of it, and they've been spreading it around and talking to people. And, it's going to take time. And the time that I understand even to get something like this moving would be about a year and a half. During that period, I hope to be able to get around to some groups to sell the idea on a me-to-the-group basis, almost one-on-one, and let them do the talking. I'm trying to get publicity on it, but as I said, it's very difficult to get your point across.
Have you brought forward the data of your, the annual financial report data?
Oh, yeah, that's involved in everything that we do. Everything that we do in the county, that's the major point that we try to get across, that, we have this deficit. I have a difficult time really getting the majority of our council really move forward on it. I don't know what it is. There just seems to be, I don't know how to describe it. They're hesitant about taking any positive steps. They just feel like, I'll tell you how silly it is here, and I'm not being facetious. This is factual. We have had, for the last 4 months, a discussion, of which I will not participate in, on whether or not to allow chickens in the communities.
Okay.
So that's the kind of stuff that's taken up their time.
I see. Okay.
We've had half-hour, 45-minute discussions at our council meetings about whether or not to allow it.
There's
more important things than that, particularly the budget. And this idea of the bank, you know, I try to bring it up all the time, but, you know, they look at me cross-eyed because, yet I try to explain it to them. I send them through the intergovernmental mail. I send them all of the flyers that I get and the information that I get, but...
Well, there's something charmingly down home about the reality of talking about allowing chickens into the community for community problem solving.
It makes good in the newspaper. They love it. The people love talking about it, and they blog on it, and they talk about it on the radio like it was a major issue. I mean, more people know about the chickens than they know about what's going on in Iraq right now.
Well, would that life were so simple, you know? We'd certainly like to be able to provide some support for the chicken farmers.
Yeah.
If they need some low-interest loans, maybe your public bank can help with that.
That's what I should do. You got it. You got it, Walt. That's what I'll do.
Well, you know, don't thank me and don't give me credit for that idea.
Okay. Well, you know, the idea about the community bank, I gave the credit to the newspaper man who presented me with the idea, but they never even mentioned it in either of the papers. Even the paper that he worked for didn't give him any credit.
Well, Ed, you know, you are at this point a pioneer in the world of creating a new American banking institution because of your role in official government. And it's going to take people like you with that kind of insight and persistence and, I suppose, courage, too, to be able to face the local challengers to bring this thing forward. So we certainly wish you well and good luck with that.
I'm going to make a serious effort to get all of the legislators in our area to a breakfast, and I'm hopeful of having a breakfast for them. However, right now, you know, it's the election season here, so they'll always have ideas why they can't make it. So after the election is over, I hope to have a breakfast the first Monday so they can all come there, the new ones and the old ones, and either cry or pound their chests and make a presentation to them at that time.
That's great. Well, you know, Ed, I congratulate you, first of all, for bringing this forward in Luzerne County, Pennsylvania. Thank you very much for joining us today, Ed.
Thank you.
That's Ed Brominski, the vice chair of the Luzerne County, Pennsylvania Council. That will do it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks this week to our guests Mike Krause of the Pennsylvania Project and Ed Brominski, the vice chair of the Luzerne County PA Council, and to Wallaby Studios in Philadelphia. For podcasts of this or previous programs, visit prn.fm or go to ellenbrown.com. You'll find Ellen's latest commentaries on ellenbrown.com, and you'll be able to subscribe to her regular articles. For copies of Ellen's books, visit webofdebt.com. And for more information about what's happening in the world of public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. On behalf of Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. Thanks for listening.